Okay, so there was a proposal by Sproggle and Steinhardt about 2 years ago that dark matter might be self-interacting. There might be a number of astrophysical problems that could be solved if dark matter could scatter from itself. It's an idea that I thought was unappealing from the particle physics point of view. But on the other hand, the astrophysical problems were there. The story that I'll tell you is kind of neat because it shows you that we can learn quite a bit about dark matter, more than just that it has some mass and gravitates. So. The reason we believe that there has to be dark matter are these flat rotation curves. So you look at a spiral galaxy, it's got a bulge, it's got a disk. In the Milky Way, we live about 8 kiloparsecs away from the center, and the extent of the luminous disk in the Milky Way is about 10 kiloparsecs. This is a rotation curve not for the Milky Way, but for some other spiral galaxy, NGC 6503, but the Milky Way's rotation curve looks more or less the same as does the rotation curve for thousands of other spiral galaxies. And the point is that the rotation curve, so this is the velocity at which stars spin around the center of the galaxy as a function of the distance from the center of the galaxy. And the velocities are small at the center, and then they rise, and then they asymptote to some flat value, and this value remains constant out to fairly large radii. The important point, though, is that if the stars in the disk, stars and gas in the disk were all the mass that was there, then you could calculate the rotation curve. You could calculate the velocities at which things spin around. At large distances, if you go to asymptotically large distances, then the galaxy would look more or less, to first approximation, like a point mass, and the rotation curve would fall as r to the minus one half. When you actually do the calculations, you find it looks more or less like r to the minus one half, but it comes up like this. So the disk and gas contribute to a rotation curve that looks like this, but the speed is much higher. And from that, we infer that there has to be more mass out there that gives rise to these large rotation curves. In the Milky Way, this asymptotes not to 120 kilometers per second, but to about 220 kilometers per second. So the first guess that you make for the shape of this halo is that it should be round. If for no other reason, just as a spherical Kao approximation. If you don't know what else it should be, spherical halo is the simplest guess. There is some observational evidence that a halo of dark matter should be or has to be spherical. I didn't mention this in Chicago. But the gas layers are confined to the disk over here. But if you actually look at the gas flares out at radii larger than the disk. So the gas is gravitationally bound to the disk where there is a disk, but when there is no disk, the gas flares out. And that tells us that the dark matter is not concentrated along a thin disk and is more diffuse. Whether it's spherical or not, I don't know, but it's not flat.
How secure is that evidence that the gas is actually? I haven't seen that before. I'm just wondering.
Oh, this is it's pretty old. The guy who does, one of the people who does this is Leo Blitz.
There aren't any observations or enough observations of objects that are outside of the plane that are.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so in the Milky Way, I don't know, but there are galaxies called polar ring galaxies that look like spiral galaxies, but then they have stuff orbiting around this way. And in those galaxies, you can infer that the dark matter has to be close to spherical.
Well, there's the stability question also.
Okay, then there's also the stability question, which is that
notice error.
The disk is unstable, actually.
Yeah,
well,
he's
you
the one
did this.
Yeah,
so
it's Jim.
But of course, you can make it stable by putting lots of velocity dispersion in the plane. But the classic argument is that of Oort. Look at stars in moving above and below the plane, like so. You measure their velocities, you measure their density run. And from that, you get the gravitational potential, which is that of a very modest mass in the disk, not enough to support the rotation curve. So the rest of the mass is going to be above and below.
But could you live with something that's 30% ellipsoidal?
No problem.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Then you'll still be supported by the spheroid. No, maybe I didn't get the direction. I don't think you want to put only 30% in the spheroid. If you put 70%, then you're surely okay.
Have people ever seen the rotation curves fall off?
Yes.
Yes,
I've seen the end of the halo.
Yeah.
Oh.
And that I think.
Not in field galaxies.
Not in fields, but in other galaxies.
Other, what do you mean, clusters or groups or something?
Because there's something. But typically it looks like this too.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know. I think there might be some in the field. Jacqueline von Porkum gives talks about this, but I don't remember if all of her galaxies were in
there. Chicago said there were observations of galaxies that didn't seem to have dark matter.
Yeah, Jacqueline von Porkum gives this talk. I don't remember whether she was talking about field galaxies or galaxies and clusters, but I thought that they were. I thought they were field galaxies.
A little off topic, but I think these are mainly groups where there's strong interactions between galaxies that mess up the rotation curves.
Okay.
That's classical Vera Rubin stuff.
Okay. So, anyway, you can apply. So, if you assume there's a spherical halo that gives rise to a rotation curve like this, it can be approximated is roughly something that falls off as 1 over r squared at large distances. If you have a halo whose density falls off as r squared at large distances, then the mass enclosed out to radius r grows linearly with the mass. And since the velocity squared is equal to the mass divided by the enclosed mass divided by the radius, the velocity remains constant. So something that falls off as 1 over r squared gives you something that looks more or less flat for a rotation curve. And you can infer that the density required locally in order to support this flat rotation curve is about 0.3 to 0.6 GeV per centimeter cubed, roughly a proton mass per centimeter cubed. So to get this answer for the local density, assuming a spherical halo, if the halo is flattened, then the density must go up because you need the same amount of mass out to some radius, but now you're compressing that mass into the disk. So if anything, this is probably a lower limit to the local dark matter density. And we also know that since these particles or objects or whatever it is that makes up this dark matter moves in the same gravitational potential well as the sun, that it must be moving with a velocity comparable to the velocity of the sun. So if you actually have an isotropic velocity distribution, then the velocity dispersion is 270 kilometers per second. So this is the evidence for dark matter, and roughly speaking, this is how one characterizes the halo. So we are very confident the stuff is not baryons. Jim, are you confident the stuff is not baryons? Oh, okay. Oh, until recently you were...
I tried hard.
Yeah, okay.
Nature is
So, the arguments are the following. We've got a theory called Big Bang nucleosynthesis that tells us how the light elements, hydrogen, deuterium, helium, and lithium, assembled in the early universe. It just applies everything that we know about nuclear reaction rates and expanding universe. This theory says that at a few seconds to a few minutes after the Big Bang, these light elements were formed, and you can predict the abundances of these light elements. And when you measure the abundances of these light elements in the universe, they agree more or less with the theory, as long as the baryon density is roughly 5% of the critical density. We also now have evidence from the acoustic peak structure in the cosmic microwave background that the baryon density is 0.05%. And this is very interesting because when you measure the baryon density from the acoustic peak structure in the cosmic microwave background, you're using completely different physics and a completely different technique to determine the baryon density. It has absolutely nothing at all to do with Big Bang nucleosynthesis. It is it's a measurement of the baryon density. And that gives you 5% as well. So a very good agreement between predictions of Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the cosmic microwave background. On the other hand, the matter density, ordinary non-relativistic matter density in the universe is about 30% of the critical density. This comes from dynamics. When you measure, say, large-scale peculiar velocity flows, or when you measure cluster masses, for example, It also comes from the cosmic microwave background, although it's not a very firm number from the cosmic microwave background. Various arguments about structure formation. If the matter density was much bigger, then structure would have formed much earlier. Structure forms differently if the matter density is very large. You would expect to see more power on small scales if you normalize the power spectrum to the cosmic microwave background if omega matter was equal to 1. And then there are also the classical tests, which suggest that the matter density is somewhere around 30% of the critical density. And 0.3 is bigger than 0.05, and it remains bigger than 0.05, even if I were to put in conservative error bars. And the other thing is that we see in clusters that the matter density is much bigger than the baryon density. So in clusters, at least, there's a hell of a lot of dark matter. The other argument, which I don't have written down, until a few years ago, people thought that maybe 5% would be enough to account for the dark matter in galactic halos. So if I wanted to make the rotation curve flat, only out to 20, 25 kiloparsecs, then the amount of matter that I need in a halo out to about 20, 25 kiloparsecs is actually less than 5% of the critical density. So until recently, people thought that you could have dark matter in the galactic halo made out of things like machos, compact stellar remnants or things like that. There are problems with that. First of all, macho doesn't see these objects. Katie has written papers ruling out all kinds of possibilities. The other thing is that the halos don't go only out to 20, 25 kiloparsecs. The halos actually extend much further, as we now know from a variety of gravitational lensing studies. So the dark halos extend out to a couple hundred kiloparsecs or so, and that is too much matter. That requires more matter than can be accounted for with 5% critical density. So the stuff cannot be baryons. So the good news is that as cosmologists, we don't have to invent a new particle.
I just want to make a comment on that, which I have been absolutely amazed how big, like, the halo of the Milky Way is. It goes almost out to Andromeda, is what I understand. I mean, galaxies are huge.
Yeah.
A lot of dark matter in there.
Yeah.
Problem keeps getting worse.
Wait, the halo goes all the way out to Andromeda.
Yeah, almost.
Well, that's just because all sort of halos are
going to
change. It's not clear either. It's not
a clear
star. It's really something.
That's why I was asking whether they ever fall off.
It's
the impression that
really
we know so much.
Yeah. Wait. So I'm the speaker and I'm the chair. So strictly speaking, there's no, if you go out into the intergalactic medium, there's no sign that says now leaving the galactic halo, entering the intergalactic medium. The point is that there is a lot of dark matter. The rotation curve is consistent with flat out to large distances. At some point, the dark matter that we associate with a halo sort of becomes confused with dark matter that we associate with the intergalactic medium. So the density is high out to a couple hundred kiloparsecs. Where it stops, that's not well defined.
But the halo density you're computing for would be centimeters, much, much higher than the closure density of the universe.
Yeah, but that's because we live in a very overdense region.
Right, so that eventually it must.
One over r squared at some radius, it becomes comparable to the mean density, and that's, you could say that's where it stops.
One over r cubed far.
Yeah, larger distances, it might be one over. So anyway, the good news is that we don't have to invent a new particle. So there are actually two particles that arise in particle physics theory that were actually invented by particle physicists, or not really invented. They were actually popped out of the theories that people had for particle physics beyond the standard model, theories that were thought of in order to solve problems with the standard model. So there's a class of particles that we refer to as weakly interacting massive particles, and the most common example is the neutralino, which is the lightest supersymmetric partner in supersymmetric, the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. If you have some new particle with some mass, m sub x, at very early times, the temperature of the universe will exceed the mass of the particle. As we go earlier and earlier in time, the temperature of the universe gets higher and higher. If we go to sufficiently early times, so time is plotted this way, at sufficiently early times, the mass of the particle will be irrelevant because the temperature will be larger than the mass of the particle, and the mean thermal energy of a particle will be proportional to the temperature. So these particles will be relativistic, and their abundances in thermal equilibrium will be comparable to the abundances of photons. However, at later times, as the universe expands, the temperature of the universe drops, and at later times, when the temperature of the universe drops below the mass of the particle, then the thermal equilibrium abundance drops exponentially because of the Boltzmann suppression factor. Okay? The probability to find the particle of mass m is proportional to e to the minus the mass of the particle divided by the temperature. So the thermal equilibrium abundance of the particle drops exponentially as the universe expands. And if thermal equilibrium were the entire story,
then there would be essentially no particles left today.
However, the process that maintains thermal equilibrium, the thermal equilibrium abundance, is annihilation of these particles, whatever they are, into ordinary standard model particles, like electron-positron pairs or quark pairs or lepton pairs, etc. And so you have, in thermal equilibrium, these particles annihilating into these lighter particles. And you also have standard model particles annihilating into these heavier WIMPs. Now, if thermal equilibrium is to be maintained, then the rate at which these reactions occur has to be larger than the expansion rate of the universe. If the expansion rate of the universe is larger than the rate at which these particles can collide, then these particles fly away from each other more rapidly than they can find each other to annihilate from, and then you don't have thermal equilibrium. So, it turns out that at early times, the rate is larger than the expansion rate, but at later times, when the thermal equilibrium abundance drops exponentially, the annihilation rate will also drop exponentially. So at some point in the history of the universe, this annihilation that maintains the thermal equilibrium abundance... What did I say?
It's just for a while it's a good news colon cosmologist.
I don't know why it does that. Anyway, so... So anyway, at some point, the WIMPs cease to freeze out, and they're left with some cosmological relic density. And if the annihilation cross-section, if the interaction strength of these particles is larger, then the annihilation cross-section will be larger. These particles will remain in thermal equilibrium longer, so that when they do freeze out, you'll have a smaller relic abundance. So if you have a large cross-section, then you expect to have a small cosmological abundance of these particles. If you have a small annihilation cross-section, weak interactions, then you'll have a larger density of these particles. And you can actually calculate this using a Boltzmann equation. It's fairly straightforward. And the relic density of these particles, which I call here chi, turns out to be about 3 times 10 to the minus 27 centimeter cubes per second, divided by the cross-section for annihilation of these particles, times the relative velocity, and here these brackets are a thermal average. And here h is the Hubble parameter, which is something like 0.65. So this cross-section is interesting. So if sigma times v is equal to 3 times 10 to the minus 27 centimeter cubed per second, then omega will be close to 1. Now it turns out that if I am considering a weakly interacting particle, and by weakly interacting I actually mean a particle that has electroweak interactions with matter, then it will annihilate, say, to electrons and positron pairs through a diagram that looks like this, where this is some type of intermediary supersymmetric particle. And the cross-section for this process, there's a coupling G here and a coupling G here. So the cross-section for this process should be roughly alpha squared divided by the mass of the particle squared. And alpha is about 10 to the minus 2, the mass of the particle in a minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, or actually in any extension of the standard model, any extension that introduces new physics at the electron weak scale, will have masses around 100 GeV. So if you take 10 to the minus 2, square it, and get 10 to the minus 4, you divide this, by 100 GeV squared, you get a cross-section after multiplying by unit conversion factors. You get a cross-section sigma that's about 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared. And then, if I multiply by the speed of light, these particles are moving at about half the speed of light when they annihilate, then I find that sigma v for a particle that has electroweak scale interactions turns out to be about 10 to the minus 27 centimeters cubed per second. So the statement is that if there's new physics beyond the standard model that introduces the existence of a stable particle, then that particle is the dark matter. Or put another way, the statement is that if there's new, I guess that's all they said. That's the way to say it. If there's new physics at the standard model that introduces a stable massive particle, that particle is the dark matter. Anyway, this is an idea that's been around for a while. I think that Zeldovich and collaborators first calculated this calculation in the 60s, yeah?
This is only true for if the mass is in a certain range, right? You haven't included the mass of the particle.
Well, the mass is about 100 GeV.
Oh, I see. You're assuming the mass is
I'm talking, or electroweak scale physics should have couplings, 10 to the minus, alphas about 10 to the minus 2, and particle mass is about 100 GeV.
All that enters here is the cross-section.
I mean, if you think about it, it's a very remarkable coincidence. This number here, this numerator, comes when you do the calculation, actually comes from the expansion rate of the universe, H naught, okay, in appropriate unions. So you're saying that the cross-section required to give you a closure density, and closure density is determined by something that tells you the expansion rate of the universe, which tells you something about the large scale structure of the universe. A priori, that should have absolutely nothing to do with electroweak scale physics. But it turns out that there's a coincidence between the expansion rate of the universe and the electroweak scale.
Is this yet another miracle?
If this particle exists, then it's a miracle.
That's the explanation. It's not connected to any of the other.
There's no other. No. No, there's no tuning here. It's just a coincidence.
The other coincidence.
Yeah. So it's a coincidence, and that's why people have taken this idea seriously. I mean, this is the most important point of the talk, perhaps. It's a very strange coincidence. And it's been around, so I think Zeldovich and collaborators did the calculation in the early 60s first. The idea that you could have a weakly interacting particle as the dark matter, I think, was introduced in the late 70s by Gunn, Schramm, Finsley, and maybe Steigman. There were several papers by those kinds of people. And they initially postulated this that this particle was a neutrino. And it turns out the neutrino doesn't work for a variety of reasons. But since then, people have studied the supersymmetric particle. The supersymmetric particle turns out to have all the properties that you want for this thing. A neutrino actually doesn't work because it turns out that if these particles are the dark matter that are running around the galactic halo, if the mass is 100 GeV, then there's roughly one of them per a tenth of a liter. A liter is 1,000 cc's, right? Okay. So there's roughly one of them or 10 of them per liter of volume. And they're moving with velocities of 300 kilometers per second or so. And so there's a flux of them passing through this room, for example. So you can build a detector. And people have built these detectors. Usually, this particle will just pass straight through the detector, but occasionally a particle can elastically scatter from a nucleus in the detector. So the detectors that people use are, for example, the same things they use for Majorana double beta decay experiments. Essentially, just a chunk of germanium nuclei. If a WIMP comes in, it can elastically scatter from a nucleus, and it's essentially a billiard ball problem because you just have a non-relativistic particle scattering from a particle at rest, scattering elastically from a particle at rest. You can calculate the energy, the recoil energy of the nucleus. And that recoil energy turns out to be 10 to 100 keV, which is the nuclear recoil energy they try to detect in double beta decay experiments. So anyway, that is why neutrinos or Dirac neutrinos aren't the dark matter. Dirac neutrinos actually have pretty big cross sections of the nuclei. And so you would have seen a Dirac neutrino in these detectors, but a supersymmetric particle does not have the same type of coherent interaction with the nucleus that the neutrino does, and so it could have already evaded the limits that have been placed by the correct detection curve.
Neutrino, Dirac neutrino also was seen in the lab.
Only if it's less massive than 50.
Yeah, but if Dirac neutrinos reactions are fixed, in order to be dark matter, it has to be lighter enough to have been.
Yes, I neglected to say that Professor Lawrence Krauss wrote a paper.
I mean, particle physics does do something.
That only works if it's greater than 50.
Yeah,
I mean, if it's less massive than 50 GeV or 40 GeV.
Yeah, but for neutrinos, the reactions are kind of fixed so that you don't have room to play like you do with SUSY.
So anyway, so people are actually looking for this thing. This is an idea that's taken very seriously, not only by theorists, by experimentalists. So there are now about something like 20 collaborations around the world looking for dark matter directly. You can also look for it indirectly. So if these WIMPs are the dark matter, they can accumulate in the sun. They can annihilate in the sun. Several people here, Katie and Lawrence, wrote some of the first papers on this stuff. They can annihilate in the sun or also the Earth. And the annihilation products can decay into high-energy neutrinos that you could see in experiments like Supercamioconda or Amanda or Macro, Gran Sasso. And those neutrinos would have energy, say, you know, tens to hundreds of GeV, so there's no way that you could confuse them with solar neutrinos. So people look for those neutrinos, and actually they don't see it, they haven't seen any yet, so that you can place an upper limit to the flux of the neutrinos, and that already rules out some models. And if these particles are the dark matter in the galactic halo, they can also annihilate in the galactic halo and produce cosmic rays, like a cosmic ray positrons and antiprotons. People also look for those. So it's an idea that's taken very seriously by theorists for good reason. There's this very strange coincidence. And it's also being taken very seriously by experimentalists. Okay. So for example, there's a group at there's a Stanford Berkeley group. I guess there's a Santa Barbara collaboration in that. Is David Caldwell still a Santa Barbara?
Harry Nelson.
Oh yeah, Harry's here, yeah. Yeah, so this is an idea that's taken very seriously.
You're going
to
say anything about heat?
Okay. There's a Michigan experiment. it's an antimatter telescope, cosmic ray telescope. They actually had a website that got this award from Netscape for, it was one of the most highly hit sites on the internet.
For different reasons.
No, it wasn't. Because it was an antimatter telescope. People love antimatter.
Although the reason I raise the issue is because they have an excess, which maybe is interesting. That's
focus.
Yes, one of the two. So let me go back. There's another candidate, which I think is also very attractive, and that's the axion. So the axion is a particle that arises in the Petri-Quinn solution to the strong CP problem. The strong CP problem is a real problem with strong interactions. There's a term in the strong interaction Lagrangian that violates CP. The coefficient of that, the coupling constant, is zero. And without the Petri-Quinn solution, there's no other way really to explain why that coupling constant should be zero. So the Petri-Quinn mechanism solves this problem with the strong interactions. But in doing so, it introduces a new particle known as the axion, which is a pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson. A priori, the Petri-Quinn solution does not tell you the mass of the axion. It could have any mass between 10 to the minus very large number of electron volts all the way up to the Planck mass. It turns out, though, that a variety of astrophysical and cosmological constraints rule out almost all of the parameter space except for two or three decades around 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 electron volts. And it turns out that if the axion does have this mass, which it must if it's the solution of the strong CP problem, then its cosmological abundance is comparable to unity. And so this particle also, in some sense, provides a natural solution to the dark matter problem. And again, there are people looking for it. There's an experiment, look for this at Los Alamos, a very elegant experiment. So it's taken seriously by people who have to actually invest time in these projects. So it turns out that the typical WIMP-WIMP elastic scattering cross-section is about 10 to the minus 40 centimeters squared. Actually, I've never calculated it. And Julie has never calculated it, but Julie has calculated something very close to it. So Julie actually calculated the elastic scattering cross-section for WIMPs with ordinary matter. Sorry, not with ordinary matter, with electrons and photons. But you'll have roughly the same types of Feynman diagrams. And the typical elastic scattering cross-section is about 10 to the minus 40 centimeters squared. And the mass of these particles is about 10 to 1,000 GeV. And so if you have a halo density of these particles, which is about a GeV per centimeter cubed, and they're running around with velocities of 300 kilometers per second, then the mean free time for a WIMP in the galactic halo to scatter elastically from another WIMP in the galactic halo is at least 13 orders of magnitude larger than the Hubble time. So these particles, if they are the dark matter, have to be collision-less, collision-free. The axion-axion cross-section actually is much smaller, and so the axion also behaves as collision-free dark matter. So these are the reasons why we have believed until now that dark matter is collisionless. There are two reasons. One is that it's easier to approximate. You're going to introduce some new type of particle or substance or objects that you know nothing about. It's easiest to start by endowing it with the simplest properties possible, which are no elastic scattering cross-section. But actually, from the particle physics point of view, there is a reason to believe these particles are collisionless.
Is this assuming that these are electroweak particles? And how do you know that cross-section?
Well, if it's related to the annihilation.
Yeah, this cross-section is fixed by the... there are two things. This cross-section is the electroweak scale cross-section, but it's also fixed by annihilation. It's also fixed by the relic density. If the stuff is to be the dark matter, it has to have an omega close to 1, and since the omega is inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section has to be close to this. And then you just flip the diagram. If I take this annihilation diagram and flip it on its side, then this is elastic scattering.
But you're always assuming that all the masses are more or less electroweak. That is important. That is an assumption
there.
They were 10 or 20 orders of magnitude bigger or smaller.
That's...
It would be governed by the mass of the particle, if it were, say, a Planck mass.
I'm going to make a comment about that later on.
Okay.
It's very, very hard to do this.
Oh, yeah, but
I don't
get that number. No, I agree with you.
Well, you have to get two numbers. You have to get the relic density,
and then
if you get the elastic scattering cross-section. I don't know if it's mathematically impossible, but it is effectively impossible. But I
agree.
So here are the reasons why people have decided to think about self-interacting dark matter. So first of all, there is a problem, halo cusp problem. And the problem is that when people do n-body simulations of structure formation or galaxy formation in hierarchical clustering models with collisionless dark matter, they find that the halos that form actually have a density that fall off as 1 over r at small radii.
That's a numerical fit?
It's a numerical fit. So, one thing you might ask is, is it just a numerical artifact? And the answer is that it's probably not a numerical artifact. A lot of people have done this with different types of techniques and different types of resolutions. And as they increase the resolution more and more, the 1 over r continues to persist. A priori, it's not so surprising. When you form a halo of collisionless dark matter, there's no natural scale in the problem. So if you were to have a core in the center, you would have to be introducing a scale somehow. So 1 over r is not it's not unreasonable to imagine that the numerical simulations are actually getting something close to the right answer. There is no really good analytical explanation for why it's 1 over r, although people are working on it. They have sort of hand-waving arguments, but you can't write down a formula.
The lack of the natural scale, it's natural for it to go like 1 over r as opposed to 1 over square root.
Oh no, it's just some power law. Yeah. I mean, it has to increase towards the center. So. I mean, other people have said that instead of 1 over r, it's 1 over r to the 1.5 or 1.2. I don't know. It's, either way, there's a problem. The thing is that the rotation curves for dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxies definitely show a core. So they do see that the... So instead of seeing a density profile that increases 1 over r at small distances, they see a density profile that increases but then flattens off near the center. Okay. So there are these rotation curves for dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxies and also low surface brightness galaxies. That's very easy. It's a low surface brightness galaxies are very good for this type of study because a low surface brightness galaxy is a spiral galaxy that's in which the disk is very, very spread out. So that even close to the center of the galaxy, there's a lot of dark matter. The rotation curve is still dominated by dark matter.
How big is this core?
In the dwarf galaxies, the core is typically 2 kiloparsecs. It varies from galaxy to galaxy, but it's on order 2 kiloparsecs.
How big are the black holes?
Oh, the region of influence of the black hole is a few parsecs. So it's a completely different scale.
So before this 1996 generation, people who thought about this, at that time they also have rotation curves for these dwarfs. So why it was not a problem then?
People didn't know what the... So before the simulations, before these simulations, it was believed that dark matter halos, when they underwent gravitational collapse, would virialize through a process known as violent relaxation. So collisionless particles can't transfer energy from each other, from one to another. But Lyndon Bell argued in the late 60s that if you have when a galaxy undergoes gravitational collapse, there's a lot of mass moving coherently, very rapidly, and that gives rise to fluctuating gravitational potential wells. And if you have particles moving in fluctuating gravitational potential well, then those particles can gain and lose energy from the potential well. And the natural energy distribution that it's going to wind up with is a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, because that's a maximum entropy solution. And if you have a self-gravitating gas of particles with a Maxwell-Boltzmann velocity distribution, then the solution is an isothermal halo, which can most generally have a core.
That's how it's steeper.
Well, a singular isothermal sphere has that. But when you do the fits to the Milky Way rotation curve, you can fit it with a core, and the dwarf galaxies could be fit with cores. The reason it wasn't a problem until 1996 is I don't think people actually had any reason to believe that it would fall as 1 over r until 1996.
But it's 2 kiloparsecs seems pretty large. I thought elliptical galaxies, lots of studies then suggested cores that are less, 100 parsecs or less. So in fact, there's a lot of studies of that. So is it really that large for dwarf?
Yep. There are several of them that are gold-plated, supposedly dwarf galaxies. And the cores vary from like 1 to 3 or 4. Kiloparsecs.
Kiloparsecs, okay, because I know for elliptical it's definitely smaller.
Yeah. Well, that's, okay, I'm going to, okay. That's what I'm going to get back to that. Okay. That's actually what kills it. So, the second problem is that
On the observational situation on the, I mean, there's some things look like they have cores, some things look like they have cusps. It's really.
Yeah, that's an important point. There are some galaxies that look like they have cores, some that look like they have cusps. There's some that definitely have cores that nobody will argue with. There's some that, well, now that I'll get to this, there's some that definitely have cusps that nobody will argue with. And then there are a whole bunch of them that people just argue on and on. So there are gold-plated dwarf galaxies that have cores and gold-plated LSPs that have cores. And then I'll show you a gold-plated cusp, too. So the other problem was halo substructure problem. So the N-body simulations show more than 10 times as many dwarf galaxies in a typical galactic halo than are observed in a galaxy like the Milky Way. So here's the simulation. So this is a dark matter simulation. And this is a simulation of a galactic halo that extends out to about 300 kiloparsecs. The mass of this halo is about 10 to the 12th solar masses, which is about the mass of a Milky Way-type halo. And you see that in this halo, there are tons of subhalos. Here's a big subhalo, smaller subhalo, tons of little dots. And if you count the number of these subhalos as a function of their internal velocity dispersions, you get something like this. So this is the cumulative number of halos. So this is the number of halos with velocities. This is the number of subhalos with velocities less than this number here. So this is the velocity dispersion of the subhalo and units of the velocity dispersion of the Milky Way. So the simulations predict that there should be several hundred of these with velocity dispersions as small as a few one-hundredths of the Milky Way velocity dispersion, whereas the number of dwarf galaxies observed are plotted here. So there are roughly 10, 11, or 12 dwarf galaxies orbiting the Milky Way, and 10, 11, or 12 is much smaller than 3 or 400. And so this is the substructure problem with standard cold dark matter. Yeah?
And could it be that the smaller halos just don't trap enough baryons to form stars, and so we don't see them?
I'll get to that. I think the answer is yes. Andrew thinks the answer is yes. So, are you going to talk about that tomorrow?
Yeah.
So I'll get to that in a second. So the solution proposed by Spergel and Steinhardt is that you hypothesize that the dark matter can elastically scatter from itself. And it's heuristically, it's easy to see how this happens. If you have particles that can scatter from themselves, let me draw a picture. If I have a halo that has a density that falls like 1 over the radius, then the particles at the center of the halo have a smaller velocity dispersion generally than the particles further out. So if I have particles running around in here, collisionless particles, if I have particles that can scatter, then one of these small velocity dispersion particles can scatter with one of the higher velocity dispersion particles. And in this way, you can transport, when you have these elastic scatterings, the effect of the elastic scattering will be to bring the temperature of the particles near the center closer to the temperature of the particles further out. So there's this energy transport, and that tends to increase the mean energies of the particles near the center. If they have larger energies, they're no longer confined to the center, and they move further out. So if these particles can elastically scatter from themselves, then you would develop a dark matter, an isothermal core at the center of the galaxy. Okay. So what you do is you choose the cross-section to be such that the radius of this isothermal core in the dwarf galaxy is about 2 kiloparsecs.
Doesn't that mean the annihilation cross-section?
That's the elastic cross-section. I agree that the annihilation cross-section should be related to the elastic scatter cross-section. But suppose you had some mechanism that decoupled the elastic and annihilation cross-section.
It could be just in the dark sector.
Yes. Right, but the particles still will elastically scatter.
So you're saying the dark sector is no other substance. There may be
something
lighter, you said,
yeah. The dark side doesn't go
lightly. Yeah. But then, yes. Then you got to worry about how they're annihilation cross-sections. Yeah, but bam.
So anyway.
Schedule spots. Seminars are on that.
No picnics.
So anyway. So anyway, so this is how this solution works. Should probably cut to the chase. So the cross sections you require is 10 to the minus 24 to the 21 to 22. There's a typo here. The cross section is about 10 to the minus 21 to 10 to the 22 centimeters times the mass of the particle in the units of GeV. The required cross section is proportional to the mass, which means that most generically you can write this as a self-opacity. And the self-opacity turns out to be 0.5 centimeters squared per gram, plus or minus a factor of 10. Okay. Now this Well, I'll get to it. So you need this type of cross-section. If you had a larger cross-section, then this solution doesn't work. So if you have a cross-section large enough so that the particles scatter roughly once in a Hubble time, then they can transport energy. If the particles scatter many more times, much more than once per Hubble time, then there's a gravothermal catastrophe, the same thing that happens in globular clusters. If the particles scatter more strongly, then they will at first form a core that looks like this, but then at later times, they'll actually make the problem worse. They'll actually produce a much steeper cusp at the center of the galaxy. So the solution only works if the cross section lives within about two orders of magnitude of parameter space. Okay. So, as a particle physicist, I think I've already expressed my reactions. Just to give you an idea, the required opacity, 0.5 centimeters squared per gram, is a huge opacity. This is five times bigger, at least, than the opacity of a photon as it passes through a plasma. So these are very strong interactions. The classic scattering cross-section has to be 13 orders of magnitude larger than allowed for a WIMP. So if this is the dark matter particle, it cannot be a thermal relic. It has to be produced in some other way. More generally, if it's a point particle, you can show the required cross-section violates unitarity if the mass is greater than the
thermal relic. If these particles are stable, these fluid directions are only in the dark sector.
Oh, I see. Only in the dark sector. So they don't. But then they can't be a thermal relic.
How do you get them by annihilation? You have to annihilate enough to freeze out. So if they're.
Yes.
No. It's expanding. You've got to have a cross section large enough to allow them, while they're still thermal, to annihilate.
In other words, you decouple the annihilation.
Yeah, I mean, you just decouple the thing and makes it pretty. That's all. Doesn't mean it's wrong. Yeah. You just decouple the coincidence that, of course.
Yeah. So, if they are point particles in a model-independent fashion, the cross section has to be less than 12 GeV. So if they're not point particles, they can have a larger mass, but then they would have to be extended objects. So people talked about things like cue balls or WIMPzillas. So these words do exist in the literature, but it's not clear how the hell these things get produced. Why is it that a cue ball, what mechanism produces cue balls or WIMPzillas in the early universe? And even worse, what mechanism produces them with just the right abundance to account for the dark matter?
Mark, what are WIMPzillas?
They're upscale WIMPs.
They're somehow bound clusters of a huge number of WIMPs.
Oh, I thought they were single massive WIMPs.
Oh, that's not, I'm thinking of something else.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of the axion bulb.
WIMPs are just gut scale dark matter. Gut mass dark matter that has weird properties.
And it's not produced as a thermal relic. So these questions are not answered by these models.
No, I'm not sure if I agree with that conclusion. Daniel Holtz and I wrote a paper. As David Gross said, we can just put these particles in the scalar gauge neutral center. We had sort of a version that consistent
with that. I didn't see that.
So basically you can tune things so that you get the proper abundance that frees that.
Yeah.
But you end up with masses that are a little heavier than that, but then you can add more fields.
Okay. I didn't see that. There was also a paper by John McDonald. Did you see that?
Right. So that, yeah, we're referencing that. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a very, very
McDonald reference.
Okay. So, as I said, this isn't a subject that I work in, right? I knew I was going to piss off somebody sooner or later, and I was just waiting for it to happen. I guess I'm assuming that the cross-section at Chicago is much larger, or at least the flux was much larger, but the audience is probably big enough for people who don't want to speak up. Anyway, so do we really need this self-interaction? I mean, do the astrophysical problems warrant changing the physics? So not necessarily. So the dwarf galaxy dearth can be solved by having gas and small halos being ejected by supernovae. supernovae go off, they blow a lot of the gas out of the halos. Dwarf galaxy formation can also be suppressed by reionization. I think we'll hear about this tomorrow. Sture et al. just argued simply that it might be a discrepancy between what you say is the halo velocity dispersion and what you actually measure in the dwarf galaxies, which is the stellar velocity dispersion. And they say that the stellar velocity dispersion is likely to be much smaller than the halo velocity dispersion. And if that's the case, then this accounts for the discrepancy. Another possible solution, although exotic, I get to put my own work in here sooner or later. So Andrew Little and I wrote a paper where we postulated or showed that if the inflaton potential has a very small break, like so, then the matter power spectrum, instead of being scale invariant at small scales, will be suppressed at small scales. And if you have suppression of the power spectrum at small scale, no small scale power means no small objects, and so you can actually reproduce the observed abundance of dwarf galaxies in this way.
Why are there oscillations?
Oh, so these oscillations are somewhat artificial. These are ringing in Fourier space from the sharp cutoff. If you smooth the cutoff, then the oscillations go away.
Mark, I don't know whether I thought that there are these astrophysical problems with cusp, but aren't there also particle physics problems from annihilation of the event?
Yeah, so I'm getting to that.
Oh, you're going to get to it. Okay. Yeah. I've never read it yet.
So here's a picture. So here's standard CDM. Here's the halo on standard CDM. Here's standard CDM with power suppressed in small scales. There's no substructure.
But it's also not clear that you want to get rid of substructure. I mean, there's some indications from gravitational lensing that by looking at the variations of light curves, sort of macro-micro lensing, that there is some structure in these halos. And at about the value you might expect in CDM, I think Kachanik's papers.
So you're saying it's dark, it's there, but it's not particularly bright.
Yeah, it's not clear exactly what they're measuring, and it's not clear if it's right, you know.
The time scales are longish.
So, what about the cusps? Do we need new interactions to account for dusks? Again, maybe not. So, baryon dark matter interactions can remove the cusps. So, the simulations that people have done have been just of collisionless matter. They don't have baryons in it. When you put baryons in the universe, baryons form bars, they form bulges, they form disks, they form molecular clouds. They're very complicated things. One example is that you could have a rapidly rotating bar at the center of the galaxy. Galaxies do have bars. If you have a rapidly rotating bar, that rapidly rotating bar produces a time-varying gravitational potential. But if I have this stick and I spin it around, then the potential changes with time. And particles, again, that move in a time-varying gravitational potential can gain or lose energy to the time-varying gravitational potential. So that can also kick dark matter particles out of the cusp.
Why would you expect to form bars?
Oh. I don't know if anybody expected it. I think that was an a posteriori. You can show it dynamically, though. There are dynamical instabilities in disks. There are bar instabilities.
You don't have dark matter, I thought, right?
Like, yeah, it's a well-known instability of...
But dark matter stops the bars, usually.
Yeah.
Or a halo.
Yeah, that's actually one of the arguments for a spherical halo.
Yeah.
If you don't have a spherical halo, then the spiral galaxy, there's an instability for the spiral galaxy to form a bar. Jim wrote the first paper on that. If Jim was here, he wouldn't say that that's actually a real reason to believe in dark matter, because the instability time scale is not clear that it's what the time scale is. But
yeah, you can calculate the time scale, you can calculate.
So, finally, it turns out that there are probably astrophysical tests that rule out standard, the self-interacting dark matter model. So let's suppose we actually do have. Suppose we took this idea seriously. Let's take the idea seriously. So we need to account for the existence of dark matter cores in dwarf galaxies. They have core radii that are about 2 kiloparsecs, and velocity dispersion is about 50 kilometers per second. Papers on self-interacting dark matter have suggested that scattering cross-sections are either constant in velocity or proportional to 1 over the velocity. Different particle physics models give you either constant velocity cross-sections or 1 over velocity cross-sections. If it's a constant velocity cross-section, then you can show that the core radius should scale as the 3/2 power of the velocity dispersion of the halo. So if you look at a galaxy cluster, which has a velocity dispersion of 1,000 kilometers per second, the core radius should be greater than about 100 kiloparsecs. So you can now look at clusters. And Jordi Meralda Escudé wrote a paper where he pointed out that there is a cluster, this one here, that acts as a strong lens. And there's a source behind the cluster that gets lensed. And the interesting thing about the images, there are two images of the source. The interesting thing is that the images are not aligned with the center of the galaxy. And the only way you can have images that are not aligned with the center of the lens is if the lens is not spherical. If dark matter is self-interacting, then the cores of the halos will thermalize, and when they thermalize, they will be spherical. So this tells you that the cores of the halos aren't spherical, and by plugging in the numbers and doing the analysis, what he finds is that the cores are spherical, are aspherical at the scales of 70 kiloparsecs, and that constrains the cross-section to be less than 0.02 centimeters squared per gram, as opposed to 0.5 required for the dark, for the dwarf galaxies. Other people have applied similar arguments using the sizes and abundances of the shapes measured from lensing, as well as other observations. They've also used lensing statistics, i.e. how many arcs are there. And they also find a number a little bigger, but still less than 0.5 centimeters squared per gram. However, both of these limits come from assuming that the cross-section is independent of velocity. So you could evade that limit by assuming that the cross-section was proportional to 1 over velocity. In that case, the clusters which have higher velocity dispersions would have particles with smaller cross-sections, and they wouldn't form these cores. But it turns out that if the cross-section goes as 1 over v to the k, then the size of the core scales as v to the 3 minus k divided by 2, and the density scales as v to the k minus 1 over 2. And now, there's a paper by Lonstein and Mushatsky from April. They did X-ray observations of a giant elliptical galaxy. So this giant elliptical galaxy has a mass, a halo mass of about 10 to the 13th solar masses. And there is X-ray gas that lives in the potential well due to this elliptical. And the X-ray gas apparently is very relaxed. It looks like a gas that can be purely described by a temperature. And if you assume that the gas lives in hydrostatic equilibrium in the gravitational in the galactic halo, then you can figure out what the density profile of the galactic halo required to give rise to that X-ray temperature profile is. And it turns out that the dark halo has to have a density profile proportional to r to the minus 1.2. And this power law extends as far in as they can see. And apparently they can see in quite large distance, I mean quite far. And they can place very stringent constraints to the size, the radius, and also the density of any putative core, which they don't see. And when they do this analysis and apply these scalings, it eliminates the 1 over V cross-section.
Is there a lot of theory that goes into this, like, thinking you understand the temperature structure and so on?
I don't think so. This is just gas and hydrostatic equilibrium. They do a lot of tests. I mean, there are all these tests that you can do to check whether it's relaxed and whether it's at a single temperature and things like that, and they do all these tests. So. But the other thing they say is they model the gas in three completely different ways, and they get three very different answers. But even in the most conservative case, the density of the at the center is two orders of magnitude larger than what is allowed from the self-interacting dark matter prediction. So it seems pretty solid. So conclusions are that it's an interesting idea, but I caution anybody to introduce new physics, new laws of physics because of things that we don't understand about galaxies. Galaxy formation is nasty. There are all kinds of things that need to be understood before you can really compare predictions of theory quantitatively with data. So my opinion is that the discrepancies that we have between theory and observations do not demand new dark matter properties. These discrepancies can probably be fixed with more traditional astrophysical mechanisms. My personal opinion is that the standard self-interacting dark matter requires dark matter particles that arise only at higher order in speculation theory. And the interesting thing is that the astrophysical data now seem to rule out this without having to invoke any type of theoretical prejudice.
Mark, yesterday Jim Peebles mentioned all these called paradoxes. Does this SIDM, does have any bearing on any of those?
No. He avoided, he avoided all of the...
Just because he's not the base.
He's talking about paradoxes because everyone talks about that.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it.